Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary. Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
What's poppin', congregation? It's your girl, Lacey Mosley, a.k.a. Scam Goddess, back with another installment of Scam Goddess, the podcast all about robbery, fraud, scams, those who practice it. Sometimes we love them. Sometimes we hate them. I don't know. We're going to figure out on the ride. Congregation, parasocial girlies, I'm very what? Yes, I'm very excited, y'all. Thrilled, elated. Y'all have no fucking idea. We have never done a podcast episode like this before, and I'm so fucking lit for this ride. Like, you guys don't even understand. Today we have an amazing documentary filmmaker, producer, and cinematographer on the show. He's directed and starred in the huge hit HBO documentary Telemarketers. Yes, get into it. He exposes the insanity and ridiculousness of telemarketing and the major scam behind the Civic Development Group. Most recently, with the successes of his documentary, which is so fucking good, I loved it, y'all, there is a movement in the U.S. Senate to push legislative effort to combat telemarketing calls, online scams, and other fraudulent schemes. We're getting after the scammers. Congregation, please welcome Sam Lippman-Stern to the show. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm glad I can curse, too.
Oh, hell yeah.
Because I speak like a sailor.
Same. I have the worst mouth. I've honestly warned my mom up to me cursing around her. Like, I can't do it too much, but sometimes I'll be like, that was fucking, and I'll be like, huh? You gonna get mad?
My mom's the same way. She still treats me like I'm a child when I curse around her. She's just like,
yes.
Hey, watch it.
Right. She'll let me have a little bit. She'll let me go a little bit, but then she'll be like, okay, now you tripping.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I love to curse. They say it releases stress.
It does.
Just
yeah.
More fuck. Fuck.
Yeah.
And I'm like, woo,
fuck,
it does.
Fuck. Yeah.
Yes. It does scare people sometimes, though.
Well, especially coming from Jersey, I think I can't say for all Jersey folk, but coming from New Jersey, I definitely have a bad mouth. That's just how I grew up.
That's how every, like, listen, that's the vibes. And like, my mom was cussing all the time, so like, I was like, girl, where do you think I learned all these spicy words? But I remember one time I got too comfortable. I was in school and I got in the car and my mom was like, do you know, like, I guess a package came or something, and she was like, do you know where this package came from? And I was in Miami, so I was just like, hell if I know. And like, just it flew out of my mouth and I was like, Now, wait, Sam, I promised one of my dear friends that I would ask you this question. So I'm going to ask you this question. Okay, so my friend Dana Labosco is from Jersey, and she wanted to know if you knew any of her cousins.
What's her last name?
Labosco?
Possibly. I feel like all Jersey people, there's like, you know, ever heard of, what is it, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Yes.
There's like the 3 degrees of Jersey.
Yes.
So I may.
And listen, I talk cash shit about Jersey. I'm going to be nice to Jersey today because you're here, Sam. But normally,
I talk shit about Jersey, too. It's
you know it's the armpit of America.
It really is.
They're going to be my ass for that.
It really is. It is the armpit of America. But but the people that are able to grow up there, I feel like there is a Jersey strong, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That turnpike energy. Yeah, y'all got
it. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm with it. So we always ask on this podcast, Sam, what is your relationship to scams? Do you love them? Do you hate them? Like, have you ever ran any? Like, what? Like, it could be anything. And I know we're going to get to telemarketers, and that's going to be a wild ride. But yeah, I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up with hippies. My parents are are total hippies, like peace and love. We were the only hippie family in the area. But my parents were very anti-materialism, anti kind of consumerism. But I don't you know, I was always hustling. I don't know what it was. I guess because we didn't really have much. So I just had in my genetics or in my whatever. My grandfather was always selling stuff too.
Because you were a child with a job, correct?
I was a child with a job.
Those are my favorite type of children. Employed ones.
I always. But I used to sell fake bootleg Rolexes.
What?
I would buy Rolexes in Chinatown on Canal Street in New York City.
Behind the brick wall?
Yeah, just all yeah, you know, have you ever been over there?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, that wall up and it's like purses and shit and all that back there. I love it.
Yes. This has been going on a long time, the bootleg culture in Chinatown. So I was probably like 9 years old or 10 years old, and I would buy I would buy the fake Rolexes for like $10, and I would sell them in school when I would sell them to the kids in the neighborhood, sell them in school. So I would always sell stuff. I remember I also used to sell Echo shirts.
Oh, I remember
I had this hustle with Echo shirts.
Oh my goodness. Blackest hustle. You were selling Echo shirts.
Yeah, Echo. I was selling Echo shirts. I used to go to a flea market in New Jersey called the English Town Flea Market. And me and my buddy, we were like 15. And they had all these Echo shirts. They weren't bootlegs. They were like seconds or thirds. So it was like they might have like a red dot on them or like a little misprint.
It was like,
but
Echo.
We would buy them. We would buy it for like $2. They had all the tags and we'd sell them for, you know, what was it? You know, 2 for $20.
Oh, that's a good flip. Okay, with the echo. Now, wait, I have one question about this. So you were selling all this stuff. Your parents, you said, were not into material. And so how did you become like hustle man?
Well, basically, I grew up in, you know, in kind of like a, I grew up in like a lower middle class neighborhood. So like everyone was always just selling stuff in that area. It was like apartment complex land, which is very central New Jersey. I mean, New Jersey is like the most populated state. So it's like the most densely populated state. So I grew up, you know, you would have so many different people living in that neighborhood. Like, you know, downstairs, you'd have someone from, you know, Colombia, right next door, you have someone from China. On the left, you have someone from Italy. It was like all immigrants and from all over the world, really diverse. And then, you know, this one like Jewish hippie family, which was my family. But everyone was always selling stuff like bicycle parts and stolen bikes
parts,
over there. And I don't know. It was pretty wild. Over
you want
in,
a wheel?
Central
I got handlebars.
Yeah. I was selling bike parts too. But I don't know. I think it was just, I don't know. I was just always drawn to it. I loved the whole buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
What can I say?
I love it. I love it. I'm a hustler, so I love it. I got six jobs. I'm a Jamaican.
Lots of respect.
Yes. But
oh, I grew up with Jamaicans too, by the way. So there was a lot of Jamaicans there in that area.
Come on, beef patties.
I think, it was, I loved growing up in Central Jersey because you just had so much like inspiration from different cultures. It was awesome.
Yeah, I think that really develops you too as a person when you get to learn from like lots of different people. And
1,000%.
Yeah, and I've always been like very immersive in like other people's cultures. And I love that. I see those vibes. Okay, last question about this before we get into what's hot and fraud. What did you spend your money on? Like you're a 9-year-old selling Rolexes. You're a 15-year-old flipping Echos. What are we spending this money on?
I used to buy. I would go and get like, I mean, Jersey pizza. You know, buying like
was that like a dollar
of,
slice?
Yeah, I think it was like a dollar slice back then. Like lots of candy, lots of like remember those like sugar drinks? They were, I don't know if you remember them, but they were these little like different drinks,
like grenade, like the little
grenade the grenade ones.
Ones.
Yeah, the grenade ones.
I've only had them with alcohol at Pride. Somebody be on the street.
yes, but I would buy those juices and
Huggies.
I'm old. Damn, I'm old now. But I used to buy all these like 25 cent honey buns and things like that. So just like, all right, candy and pizza, I guess, which sounds terrible. But
I love that you were working like an adult, but you were spending like a child. That is so funny.
I never thought about it. We had one more hustle, one more, ooh, I guess, semi-scam. I just remembered. So they used to have this Coca-Cola contest where if you open the cap on the Coca-Cola, and it said you could win a prize under the cap.
Yeah, I remember that.
So, So me and my group of like wild friends, we somehow figured out that if we go to the recycling center, which back then you could just walk into, like no adult, like no one was overseeing there. You could just go in to the recycling center.
Twist that scam. You and the recycle center. Why is that baby here? We don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. And we would just go through all the Coke bottles, and we literally had like, I remember one day we walked in with like 50 of those bottle caps. Cause I guess people weren't actually checking the bottle caps. So we had, we walked into Quick Check and we had like 50 free Coke. And we were, anyway, that was another little childhood.
You are a genius. Scam. That is so inventive to think like, let's go to the recycling center. I love that in your youth, you were just like, come on, gang, we're going to the recycling center. Everybody else skipping rocks and doing kickflips on, you know, skateboards. And you're at the recycling center. Like, getting
we were so sugar high that day. It was really bad. We drank a lot of, and I guess caffeine, a lot of Coke.
Y'all were hype. We were
hype as fuck.
I love the inventism. I love that you like come up with all the like that's the mark of a genius. Like when you're thinking like that. Like, and I love that because it's like also scammers, you know? Like, but you used it for good. You're recycling and shit. And that also makes me think of the fact that why don't they do sweepstakes or prizes anymore? Where's the Monopoly game, McDonald's? I know you had a big scam, but that scam is over. Help us out. Like, now they're just like, we're going to charge you whatever we want, bitch, and you're going to take it because the economy is falling apart.
We got to bring back contests.
Yeah. We need joy. I would take popping a cap and being like, woohoo, a free Coke.
Yeah.
Like, help me. I'm sad.
Coca-Cola, bring back the bottle cap. Yes. Competitions and
bring back the bottle cap because they went very influencer for a little bit and they were like, oh, you could get a Coca-Cola with your name on it and take a picture so you give us free engagement. It's like, no, give me a free Coke, bitch. Okay,
yeah.
I deserve it.
I want free stuff.
Life is hard. Give me a free Coke. Give me a Monopoly piece. Like the dollar menu ain't dollaring no more. Like help us out. Like please.
Yeah. 100%, yeah, absolutely.
So let's get into our next segment here, What's Hot in Fraud. This is where we warn our listeners about popping frauds in the zeitgeist. And more often than not these days, we get a letter from our listeners. As y'all know, snitch on your friends, your enemies, your family, everybody at scamgoddesspod@gmail.com. Just make sure the scam is retired because we don't want to what? Yes. Fuck up your bag. Amen. So I just need a fake name. Gender is a construct. It doesn't matter from you, Sam. Whatever fake name you want to give me.
Yeah, Fred.
Fred. I like Fred. I like a Frederick.
Frederick. Yeah, Fred. Let's go with Frederick. How about that? Let's go
Frederick.
With
Frederick. Yes. Yeah. So Frederick says, hi, Lacey. I'm just going to dive right into it. See the flowers at the end. Oh, you'd be listening to the show. I love you, Frederick, already. So Frederick says, a few years ago, after I graduated college, I moved from a small town in the Midwest to New York City to pursue a master's degree in media scoring. Now, the school itself was a huge scam. So after my first semester there, I was actively looking for a way out. So one day, one of my faculty members came up to me and said, hey, I think there may be a position on a project that my friend is working on that might be good for you. Obviously, I'm intrigued. I asked about it. She told me that the main composer was looking for an orchestral assistant, which should have been my first red flag because that isn't a real position. Yeah, I don't know what an orchestral assistant is. You hold the little pointy stick for him or something?
I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, but that sounds about right.
Right. I'm like, what are you carrying?
I'll take
drums?
It.
Right. You bring the violin. What is an orchestral assistant? You fix the chairs?
Not sure.
First chair? I don't know. So that should have been the first red flag, Frederick says, because it's not a real position. What it came down to was that I'd be a composer's assistant, the orchestrator, and the copyist all rolled into one. So this is not my lane. I don't know about the work. I know they got first chair and the girls be fighting for it. And that's about it.
Yeah, I know less. I know less. But as someone who likes scams, I think we can help.
Right. Maybe we can help here. So it says, I figured it would be a lot of work, but I was happy to do the job of three people in order to get out of grad school and launch my career. And that's how they get us in America. Because like, even with these layoffs and shit, it's like, oh, if you don't get laid off, they're like, yeah, you didn't get laid off, but now you got six jobs. But we're going to pay you to
Yep. Yes.
And you're going to be grateful that you're still employed.
Totally.
So after a few interviews over, in all caps, Facebook video chat, second red flag.
Yes.
I was hired and given an offer of a $250,000 salary.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's good as hell. Like, shit, I'm in.
Let's go.
What I got to do? I carry the pointy stick? What are we doing?
Me too. Let's go. Let's get into the orchestra business.
Right. Let's get into the orchestra business. Listen, let me get my sheet music. I got y'all.
Yeah.
What are we doing? Beethoven? Let's go. So, honestly, in the moment, I was just happy that my dreams of working in film were coming true. So I was blind to all these warning signs. I ended up dropping out of college so I could focus 100% on the project. So now they've dropped out of school over a face for a fake job over a Facebook video chat messenger. I just feel like employers, if you tell me to hop on Facebook, then are you really trying to hire me? What's going on?
My red flag bells are just going off as I'm hearing this.
Yes. So, and I mean, you have experience in a job that turns out to be a scam.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I learned.
It's too good to be true. So about after 4 months of delays, we finally started working in an actual studio. However, I found this confusing as the film wasn't even made yet. I guess we were just making music before the film. And then later, we would edit it to fit the film. Usually, unless the music is an integral part of the project, like filmed, musical, or whatever, music is one of the last steps in production. So this is the third red flag, which makes sense because how you going... Like, what if you, like, were scoring Moonlight and you made all these, like, like, happy-ass tunes and then the movie's, like, sad as fuck? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Nicholas Britell's just doing his thing before he knows what's going on. Like,
I'd like to see
died.
That, actually.
We could put in a wah-wah. Does that help? Like, when they die? Is that who? Like, yeah, so this is weird. So after 2 weeks of hard work, I was looking forward to my first paycheck, $10,000 for the first week of production and another $10,000 starting bonus to account for the 4 months of delays. I had been living off of student loans and ramen noodles. No, not Sally Mae. No. Sally and ramen. So up to that point, I was hurting bad for that money, but it never came. It turns out the composer, who was also an executive producer, in quotes, never had any money to pay us or the studio space from the start. So he ain't paying nobody, not even the studio.
Wow.
The studios are expensive. Did you work like in a studio ever when you were doing voiceover for your documentary?
We did a little bit. Yeah, I did work in a studio.
It was like a nice one?
Yeah, it was really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. What city did you do it? Did you do it in Jersey or New York?
In New York.
Okay. Yeah. It's expensive. Studio time is crazy. So it's like, which
is
expensive?
Really? Yeah, it was. I mean, I don't know the prices of it because, you know, I just have to go in and do my job. But I will say there were lots of free snacks, which I took full advantage of as a scammer.
You just walked out with the basket. No, I'm taking the basket.
I definitely pocketed some snacks on the way out, for sure.
As you should. You leaving with something. Denzel.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
Oh, so orchestra assistants, I guess we pulled this up. They're responsible for assisting the orchestra manager. The responsibilities are like dealing with any problems that arise with the orchestra, late arrival of instruments to an auditorium, a musician becoming ill and needing a replacement. So they're just like the manager. They're like keeping things flowing.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So this was this person's job. Frederick was like the manager of a very unpaid and broke ass position. So he was using, we had done 2 weeks of work for free, Frederick says. After that, he almost completely disappeared off the face of the planet. He was hard to reach by phone, and every month he'd hold an update meeting about where the funds would be.
Oh, God.
And after January of last year, contact stopped altogether. He
said, no.
Not an update on where my money is. He was like,
oh, God.
Not a UPS tracking number on my money. Give me my money.
Oh,
so your money is at the center now. It's being handled.
Oh, man.
Your money's out for delivery. No. So now I want to sue for my unpaid wages, except for the fact that I didn't realize that I didn't have a single copy of the paperwork with both of our signatures on it. So all I had were sheets of paper where I agreed to work for them, but nothing with the composer agreeing at all. So the composer never signed his name. So basically he's like, I never saw it.
Wow.
That is so messed up.
Yeah, that's really messed up. You're messing with people's dreams here, scammers.
Yes. This person dropped out of school. So thankfully, a lot of financial struggling. I'm back on my feet again. I wouldn't be here without the support of my friends, my family, my awesome partner, and 2.5 years of climbing the music ladder here. I'm finally having my first East Coast premiere of a piece that I wrote. Just remember, though, if it's too good to be true, it probably is, and you should get the fuck out of there as soon as you can. Yes. I know that's right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, and then I'm reading the nice things down here. This is very sweet, Frederick. Thank you so much. Scams!
I love
fashion, okay? But we all know buying the latest and the greatest constantly is a little bit of a scam to the planet, which is why I love Nuuly. It's a subscription clothing rental service that's all about helping you have fun and get creative with your style. Sometimes you put something on the gram and you feel like, oh, well, it's dead now. Well, with Nuuly, you can keep having fresh fits. And you're helping the planet. Try out trending styles, colors, silhouettes, and then you can send it back for something new. Okay? Come on, Nuuly. For just $98 a month, you get your choice of any 6 styles each month, access to thousands of styles for more than 400 brands with inclusive sizing. I know that's right. It's fast, free shipping and returns with professional cleaning in Nuuly's state-of-the-art laundering facility. Plus, the option to buy whatever you love, which I love that because sometimes I put on a piece and I'm like, it's mine now. So you can buy it from Nuuly. I love using Nuuly because the free shipping, it's really quick, and the pieces are really nice quality. Also, I love that the orders, like when I got mine, it was shipped in a recyclable, reusable tote. Nuuly is a great value at $98 a month for any 6 styles. But right now, you can get $20 off your first month of Nuuly when you sign up with the code GODDESS20. Just go to Nuuly.com. That's Nuuly with 2 U's. And enter the code GODDESS20 and sign up to get $20 off your first month. That's Nuuly.com. Nuuly with 2 U's with code GODDESS20. Nuuly subscription clothing rental. Change your clothes. Ooh, do you feel that in the air? Yes, that is summertime. It's in the breeze. It's in the trees. And y'all know when the sky comes out, the thighs come out. And as the weather gets hotter, it's time to say bye to jackets and sweaters and hey to shorts and tees. If you've been wanting to update your wardrobe for the long haul without spending a fortune, Quince is for you. Y'all know I love Quince. If you want to be looking chic year after year with classic pieces that you can dress up, dress down, wear around town, you got to get into Quince. They have premium European linen dresses. I have one in green, and oh, when I wear it, it is a showstopper. Blouses, shorts from $30, y'all. Washable silk tops, which I told y'all I love those. I actually went back and got it in navy. I got it in the white, like cream, and I just know when I wear it, I'm going to feel like Diane Keaton on the beach thinking about my life. Like white cream, are you kidding me? It's giving rich, okay? Quince is that girl. Y'all know you see me in their pieces all the time. Get into it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/goddess for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/goddess to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/goddess. Let's get into the meat. Historic hoodwinks. This is where we regale our audience with a famous con caper group of criminals, and we'll see how it shakes out. Maybe we love them, maybe we hate them. This is different because Sam lived this. So I'm gonna proceed. I'm kind of nervous, Sam, because I've never had someone who lived the scam on. So I'm very excited.
Well, I'm honored to be here for the first one.
It's That's thrilling.
Appreciate you.
So telemarketing has been a service utilized by business since the 19th century. It allows people to sell products, subscriptions, or services to prospective customers. Since the use of computers became more common than the switchboard operators, companies such as Civic Development Group have used the practice for fraudulent means. So the beginning of CDG, we're going to give a little history here. The CDG was founded in the 90s, like 1990s. Its model was simple. Employees of the telemarketing company made calls on behalf of nonprofits and charities to solicit donations from citizens. The company was owned by Steve Pash and Mark Keezer and ran by their brothers, David Keezer and Brian Pash and Glenn Pash. Fun fact, one of the brothers, Steve Pash, was in a Christian rock band. And I have heard the Christian rock band movies or music, like Three Cross. in the 90s with Anthony Crisian of the Spin Doctors. So now, Sam, how did you feel when you found out the head of this company were goofy as hell? Like, how did you feel when you found out they were so goofy?
I loved it.
Have you ever met them?
I loved it. I thought it was so ridiculous. I mean, here these guys were, you know, essentially, you know, scamming hundreds of millions of dollars in the name of the police and other charities. And, you know, they used, I don't know how much of that, but, you know, a decent amount of that money to try to fund their rock careers. There was two rock careers. One was a Christian rock band, mm-hmm. and then the other one was another band called the J. Henry Band. And this guy, J. Henry, it was another brother, and he was just terrible. I mean, it was, I'm a generous type of person. And, no, but it's just tough to listen to. It's really bad. It's tough to listen to. So,
painful.
But I thought it was great. I thought it was hilarious.
Wait, I have to ask, which band? Okay, so the Three Crosses is better than you?
I would say, the Three Crosses is, you know, it's very ironic that it's Christian rock because, you know, they're
doing non-godly things like crime.
Yes. And then the other one was just kind of a Bruce Springsteen wannabe kind of hard rock band led by this Scott Pash called J. Henry. And it's just real bad. And he spent a lot of money on that career. I heard he paid to open up on or to perform on in Carnegie Hall in New York while I was telemarketing. And
he was using the call coins to pay for his own concert. Oh, yes. Man.
And a 250, I think it was a $200,000 or $250,000 guitar collection when the company finally did get shut down.
I heard about that. They had a lot of expensive shit, a lot of homes. Oh my goodness. First, I have to ask you, how did you, because I know you were young when you started working at the telemarketing place. What drew you to it? Did you see an ad? Did you walk by? What happened?
Good question. So I was I was in ninth grade. I was 14. Mm-hmm. And I just hated school. I didn't want to go to school anymore. So I started taking off Mondays. So I just wouldn't show up on Monday. So I do a 3-day weekend. Yeah.
Take Mondays off of school.
I would do 3-day weekends for a while. And then I decided, I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Like I couldn't do school anymore. So I told my parents that I was going to leave school and basically drop out. And again, they're hippies and they were pretty, you know, they're like, look, you can leave, but you got to get a job. That was their, you got to get a job and you got to get your GED. Those were the two things. So if you're going to leave school, job, GED.
I kind of love that.
I left school. And I went to look for a job. So I went to Burger King and McDonald's first. Mm. They both told me I was too young. This is like 2001, right
now
after 9/11.
Totally.
They're like, you're too young, can't work here. I told a good friend of mine who was, I think, 15 or 16, that I was having trouble finding a job. And he told me, dude, I got you. I work at this call center in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I swear they'll hire you. You're good. So I went with him. I remember riding my bike across from Highland Park, New Jersey, where I grew up, into New Brunswick, where Rutgers University is. It's most
How
known
far
for
is that?
Rutgers. It's like a 10-minute, 15-minute bike ride from my house. And I went into the office. The managers had me read the script, and they hired me right away. And I started the next day at 14 years old, and I ended up working there for 7 years.
Wow.
Off and on. So I would work
21,
for, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was 22 when I left. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was late 2009. And it was a wild, insane job.
So when you read the script, it's like an audition? Like they just had you read it in front of them?
Yeah, I think, they just had me read it in front of them. And at that point, I had no idea what the job was at all. I just knew, okay, it's something on the phone, some kind of telemarketing job.
Right.
But once I started, basically the idea was to teach the managers taught me how to sound like a cop.
Oh, shit.
So, like, how does a cop sound in, like, a 1950s cartoon? That was the idea, because we were raising money for police organizations and charities over the phone and calling citizens all around the country. So our job as a caller was, how do you sound like the idea of what a cop sounds like? So, like, hi, Sam Lippman Stern calling on behalf of the New Jersey Fraternal Order of Police. Good afternoon and God bless. You know, like that kind of They teach you how to sound like a cop.
Wow. And had your voice dropped by then? Did you
My voice had not fully dropped. It was okay. it was like almost, it was dropped, but not the, where as deep as it is now. But it was
this little baby was dropped voice enough. Like, I'm calling from the police. Bring me the money.
Oh, but that was the job. It was a raise donation.
Yes, for these organizations. And we're going to get into that even further. But so they wrote these scripts, right? The calls consisted of making pitches to local civilians, like you said, to donate to a number of charities and nonprofits. In the beginning of the money that was donated was like what 10% actually went to the destination of the callers that they like thought they were donating to, right? So in the beginning, it was like 10%.
It was a 90-10 split. So the company would keep 90% of the donations and they'd give the police organization or other charity on average 10% of the money.
So it was like a kickback for using their name.
Yeah, basically, that was the idea. It's like, all right, we'll use your name. You don't have to do anything other than loan your name and just collect this money.
So in order to further convince citizens to donate to the Fraternal Order of Police, donors were told that they would receive sticker decals that would not only show their support, but they could potentially help them get out of a ticket. So this is the sticker decal. It looks very official. It definitely looks like it's some kind of organization. And for me personally, like, I've been thinking about maybe getting one of those thin blue line stickers. I hate the police, but I was like, maybe they'll stay off my ass if I'm like, ooh, I love violence from the police as a black person.
Yeah, that's how CDG, Civic Development Group, became the number one fundraising company for police organizations in the United States. I mean, they were, you know, you're going to donate to the police. We'll send you out the sticker. Put it on the back of your car, and it may get you out of a ticket.
And that's such a great ruse. Because
it
like,
is, yeah.
Because then, like, I would donate to that. I hate the fucking police. And I would be like, put that on the back of my car so they don't pull me over and try to kill me. You know, like,
totally.
Whatever it takes. I've actually gotten out of a ticket because I knew somebody who actually really, like, probably... I can't say too much, but they know the police and the police know them. And so I was on my way to work for them and I cut off a sheriff by accident. And I was like, oh my God, my bad. Like when they pulled me over, I was like, I'm just headed to work. And I told them where I worked and they were like, oh, you know, Jack Johnson? Oh, nah, we can't give Jack Johnson's employee a ticket. And they let me go.
Yeah. Well, I remember I grew up as a graffiti writer. So before I got into film, I was always painting graffiti. That was my big passion. I remember when I was like 18, my house got raided for graffiti.
No, what and, is that? Raided for graffiti?
Raided, yeah. That's all. Yep. And I remember telling the detectives, I'm like, I work for you guys. What are you doing? Like, I literally call for you for the police all day. And they're just like, what are you talking about? Like, they had no idea what I was talking
about. Damn, so you tried to use it and it didn't work?
I did. I've tried to use it a couple of times.
So they got these sticker decals, and that's how... Like you were saying, CDG got real popping. So lies employees would tell grew so extreme that many employees began claiming that the stickers even bought police protection. Did you say that to someone? Did they tell you to say
that? Well, I would not do so. I wouldn't say that. So what I would say is this: personally, I would be like, I'd be like, okay, we're gonna send you out a new, you know, 2023 active supporter decal. Now, do me a favor. You put that decal right on the back of your vehicle or the front of your house to show your proud personal support for the police. And all the officers out there will see your support. Like, basically, you're what I would do. Well, back in the day, before I worked there, people would straight up say they were cops.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's...
So it was like super Wild West in the 90s. I mean, they'd be like, hey, this is Officer Callahan calling from the local FOP, you know? So...
Callahan, then they, that's a good one.
Yeah. Then they had a lawsuit, and at least the company I worked for, they kind of cracked down on things a little bit. So you wouldn't say you were a cop, but it was like you were kind of trying to say you were a cop without actually saying it.
You're like, hold on, we got a 112 in progress.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, in episode 2, we there's one of the guys that we profile, and he would use the police scanners in the background, and he was, so a lot of, you know, it depended on the company you worked for, but CDG specifically, they went from, first they would tell people, have, you know, people would say, yeah, we're, hey, it's, you know, officer, you know, Bob, whatever. Just, and people would make up phone voices too. And then when the first lawsuit they had in the late 90s, and I think it was 1998, they kind of started, you know, they started putting in some more rules and kind of not, they weren't saying they were cops anymore on the phone, at least that company. Right.
So that's just massaging it now. Like, we're not massaging, saying we're cops. Yes. We got cop voices. We got scanners in the back. They're like, hold on, we got an APB 112. And then you just hear somebody getting beat with a nightstick. Ow, ow. So anyways, can you donate to the police? Yeah,
exactly. And you still get your sticker. You still get, sometimes we do a card, a police card for your wallet.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Or a shield. Like, you'll see them all over New Jersey, these gold shields. If you spend a lot of money, you get a gold shield.
That is wild. And it's funny to me that we basically militarized the police and given them so much money because that's how they think that we fight crime. But really, it's like we need to help people. There's less crime in areas where people have housing and aren't, you know, suffering on the streets. And it's like, no, we'll give more money to the police so they can beat them up real good. And I'm like, no, that's not the answer.
Well, that's a big layer to this story, because this is like historically how, you know, our biggest client at CDG was the Fraternal Order of Police. That's the mm-hmm. biggest police organization in the world and the biggest police union in the United States. And that was CDG's biggest client, was, you know, various state lodges of the Fraternal Order of Police. And, you know, they were raising hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, where was that? They were saying it was going to the family. So what we would say was that the donation would go to help the families of officers killed or injured in the line of duty.
Yeah.
But what it really went to, after we looked into it, a lot of it went into, you know, huge amount went into lobbying, right? So they were basically using that money to lobby, to keep laws and basically to keep laws the way they've been. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even mention the fact that, you know, the majority of the callers were, you know, ex-convicts that were caught up in the prison pipeline.
Which is so wild. It's so ironic that now they're like raising funds for like the literal like ops, like people that yeah. they hate. But it's like, it's hard to get a job when you're an ex-convict. And that's why like recidivism happens. So it's like they got a job, so they're not going to. And like, speaking of the employees, they were making calls and they made what, like $10 an hour with quotas, but no commission and extreme pressure to make numbers.
Yeah.
I feel like you were good at this, right? Like, I feel like you were really good at this. Like, you and Pat. Like, Pat was really good too, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're some of the best callers in the office. Basically, everyone that we interviewed were like the kind of, you know, lifer, OG, CDG mm-hmm. folks. Pat was one of the best callers. I was one of the best callers there. And yeah, totally. We got really good at it.
Yeah, and according to a former manager, this is a quote, said, we would allow the guys to do whatever they needed to get through their shift and hit their numbers. So I watched your doc, and this is by far the wildest work environment. And I worked at places in the Hamptons where some of the servers were selling cocaine. So I was like, whoa, like, I mean, we'll put this on the Instagram, but when I watched this video of the office, I was like, so people are just like lit as fuck, drinking, doing drugs, partying. What was that like? Like, being there as a child and all these like wild adults.
The first time I walked into CDG, I was 14, you know, I remember I walked in and there was like all these built dudes, like jack dudes, doing push-ups by the water fountain.
What?
And then I walked in and there's mugshots of the callers on the wall, like trophies or like badges of honor, like printed out mugshots.
Wow.
And then I remember, there was this one manager came up to me and he pointed at this guy, Mr. Smythe, who's in episode one. He has, and Mr. Smythe is like, he's actually a good friend of mine now. I've known him for a long time. Really sweet guy, but he's an eccentric man and he's odd looking. He had these big, bushy eyebrows, very unkempt, and he'd wear, like, these boots that looked like they'd seen Vietnam War. And the manager pointed to that guy, you know, I'm 14, he points to that guy, to Mr. Smythe, and he goes, you see that guy over there? One day, I'll bet good money on it. He's going to come in here with an AK-47 and shoot this entire office up.
Oh, my God.
And that was, like, my first memories.
This is orientation?
At CDG. That was orientation. So, I mean, CDG was wild. I mean, you would see, you know, fights break out, FBI agents pull out callers. I mean, you'd have a bank robber who actually ended up, you know, being caught robbing banks on your left, and then like a murderer on your right. Multiple drug kingpins, but one in particular that was selling massive, massive amounts of heroin out of the office. I mean, there was prostitution going on. There's one guy that would set up a bootleg. One of the cubicles would just have like bootlegged jerseys and DVDs and
hustle from a childhood.
Yeah.
So it's like all of these people are working here, but then they're all doing other jobs. Some of them are slanging coochie. Some of them are slanging heroin. They're slanging DVDs.
Everyone was hustling out of the job. So you'd get your 10 bucks an hour, but then you'd also, you know, you'd sell weed or, I mean, you could buy whatever you wanted in there. And it was just, and everyone was on drugs too. I mean, there was, you know, everyone was doing drugs. It was, so for as a 14-year-old, for me, it was just kind of like, first, I thought it was really interesting. Right. I thought, you know, I was.
You didn't see the danger. You saw people doing push-ups by the water cooler. And you was like, yeah, sparkless and workouts. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So I was, you know, I was smoking weed in there too. And I was just I was also a graffiti writer. So for me, I kind of grew up there, right? Mm-hmm. These guys saw me, and I was a high school dropout. So they kind of like, we're all in the bottom of society, and it kind of created this dysfunctional family. Yeah. So everyone really kind of looked after me in a way as like a kid working in this crazy office. It just became my norm. You know, my days would be, my nights would be spent doing graffiti. My days are spent calling for police organizations in this crazy office.
So you don't sleep.
No sleep. Exactly. And I don't know. I thought, for me, it was just really entertaining in a way. It was just so strange and entertaining. And at first I thought someone should write a book about it. I'm like, someone needs to write a book about this place, because you couldn't make up these characters and all these really interesting people with such interesting, strange backgrounds. Whether, you know, there was like, I remember sometimes there would be, you know, 20 guys that were just from the halfway house. So they'd right out of prison, you know, they'd be in the halfway house. They'd come take the train to work, call their parole officer and go right back to the halfway house. And like all these interesting people sharing their stories.
So this is like The Office, but like if it was like the prison version.
Yeah, basically. Yeah,
because the yard is definitely where the sparkless was, because they was getting their workout in, and then you got fights, yeah. You got people selling bootlegs, so you can buy Pootie Tang and one person's cubicle. I love this. But I have a question. Do you remember like the reason any fight broke out? Because I'm like, how big was this office? Yeah, okay, yes.
The office was pretty big. I think you'd have, so we had half the office in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That was the one that I worked at, was Spanish. So calling Spanish. And it was cut down the middle. So half the office was Spanish, and then the other half was English.
Okay, so it was like and, SAP and then English, okay.
Yeah, and so I was in the English section. And I mean, basically, I remember one fight in particular. You know, one guy had just got out of prison, and one of the managers, who was a total asshole, and actually ended up becoming a corrections officer after Civic Development Group. Yeah, but this guy was a prick. Like, nobody
That's
liked
what I'm
him.
Saying. Like, that's why he probably took that job. He was
totally.
He was like, I have tons of practice. I've been to a correction officer at my call center, and now I'm gonna do it for real. Yeah.
Yeah. But this guy was just yelling at this one caller, and this caller just, he took it for a little bit, but then right in the middle of the shift, I remember all of a sudden everyone's dropping their headsets and jumping back because there was like a Looney Tunes style brawl going on.
Dust clouds, legs and arms.
And birds, you know, over their heads. This dude was just beating this manager's ass. And so he really beat the shit out of him. This guy was fucked up, this manager. And I don't even know if the caller got fired. I think he got sent home that day. But there's photos of the manager's face on one of my friends' Facebook pages.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, old photos, yeah. So that was one of the many fights. Oh, one more was that the guy that would sell bootlegs in his cubicle, he sold the wrong person a bootleg jersey that had one of the players' names wrong. And the guy didn't notice that the players, it was like, he bought like a Michael Jordan, let's just say, for example, jersey, but it was spelled like Michael,
Michelle Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy that bought it didn't realize it until everyone in the office started making fun of him.
Oh, no.
He was wearing the jersey, and man, he beat that guy's ass.
Wow.
So that was one of the couple of the memorable fights.
That's what a real office. Life consequence. Like he did want to return to Jersey. He also had to return some hands on this man.
Yeah. Because everyone was cracking on him in the office and he was just like not having it.
Oh my goodness. I cannot imagine. This is so wild. And like seeing the, like even what you have in the documentary, I was like, what the hell? But I love that it's like the punishment is like, oh, you beat up the manager. Just walk it off. Come back tomorrow. Don't beat him up again.
Oh yeah. No, totally. Like you really could do, if as long as you were selling and it was like $200 an hour on average, they wanted you to get in donations. If you could hit those numbers, you were good. It didn't matter if you were doing heroin in the office or whatever the heck you were doing, you were good.
As long as you're making them phone calls. Crack!
Yep, exactly.
Okay? Exactly. That makes you work faster, okay?
Yeah.
Okay? Who can sell? Crack? People on crack can sell things.
Yeah.
Very well. Okay? So, the call centers were so crazy, and we have a video from your documentary, that one CDG employee, Sam Lippman-Stern, yes, and Pat, your friend Pat Pespisis. Am I saying his last name correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes. Yeah.
So Pat was a friend and coworker and co-star in your documentary. Pat cracked me up. Like, he was cracking me up. So, you guys recorded antics and posted the videos to YouTube. One story emerged from the documentary was your friendship with Pat for over 20 years that you worked on this documentary, Telemarketers. Like, can you describe your relationship during this documentary with Pat? Because, like, I watched the documentary. You guys seem very close. And Pat is obviously, like, an eccentric guy. But he also, like, had, like, a lot of passion and a lot of, like, insight into this world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I first met Pat. When I first met Pat, I remember he walked up to me in the office and he's like, hey, Hamilton Stern, can I bum a schmog? He thought my name was Hamilton Stern for some reason. And he's like, can I bum a schmog? I'm like, what's a schmog? He's like, a cigarette. Can I bum a cigarette? I'm like, hey, sorry, I don't smoke. I'm like, and my name's Lippman Stern. And he goes, oh, I thought your name was Hamilton Stern. Sorry. And we were friends ever since. But Pat is like, Pat's an amazing person. He's one of my best friends. I consider him family. You know, Pat was working at CDG and he was in his probably mid to late 30s at the time. And I was a teenager and we just became friends, you know. I was filming in the office first with a manager named Big Ed. Rest in peace, Big Ed. And he was the one that encouraged me to bring in the camera. And we started just filming all these antics in the office. And Pat became the quick star. Like, everyone knew Pat in the office. Everyone loved Pat. He loved being on camera. He was super charismatic.
Yeah, so much energy.
And so, yeah, we just started filming Pat. And the idea let's just make videos for YouTube, which YouTube had just came out at that time. It was around 2005.
Yeah, Janet Jackson invented YouTube.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to see the titty pop out again, and that's when
YouTube popped
off.
Oh, I do remember
that
now. Yeah. But then we were like, why don't we make a documentary about a day in the life of a CDG caller featuring Pat as the most likable, interesting character. And then I just started filming with Pat. And then Pat was the one that was like, hey, man, there's some really, we're involved in a scam.
Yes.
We have to, let's not do a documentary about me. Let's do a documentary exposing this scam to the world. And I've been, you know, and that was, ended up being like a, you know, almost 20 year journey.
Right. And I mean, that's, I think it's, to stay dedicated to it for that long and then the product just be so amazing from like all of your work and efforts. It's just that kind of steadfast. Like, I want that kind of perseverance because it turned out amazing. Like, just.
Well, I hope it inspires people out there just to finish your project. You know,
yes.
Definitely a labor of love, and yeah, blessed that it finally all came together after
sometimes
all these crazy years.
Yes, through all these antics. Oh my goodness, Pat was killing me. I love that y'all were like on road trips, and Pat would be like, I gotta get out and like feed the alligators or like stare at a rainbow. And I was like, yes, I need this energy.
Robbery! Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. On each episode of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop, comedians join host Misha Brown to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? When they launched their Pepsi points system, they never imagined somebody might try to actually snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you have an unemployed roommate at home? You know who I'm talking about. Children. Yes, Whitney said they are our future, and don't you want to invest in theirs? I know you want to set your children up for success. Maybe you want to save a little coin on private tutoring because we know that inflation is high and these wages are not getting higher, okay? Which is why I love IXL Learning. IXL Learning, it's an online program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything itself. No more trying to scam your kids as you try to figure out their math equations and their homework. And you know you haven't seen a trapezoid in about 20 years, right? So let IXL help you out. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning and get IXL now. And Scam Goddess listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/goddess. Visit IXL.com/goddess to get the most effective learning program out there for the best price.
And fraud! So many CDG employees, like we've talked about, are former convicts who were unable to find employment due to their record, which is why recidivism happens. We talked about that. So the call centers were notorious for a variety of criminal activity, which you also talked about, Sam. And according to several CDG employees, hiring former convicts was key because they know how to get money out of people and they're not going to say anything about suspicious activities. So they're not going to snitch. They also need a job, especially if you're like in a halfway house, like you have to have employment, right?
Yep, exactly.
So it's like these are vulnerable people. So in your documentary, you highlighted how predatory the company was to former employees like yourself. In what ways, like, did they make people feel like they couldn't leave, or like did you feel like any kind of weird pressures from the company to obviously to perform and sell a lot, but anything else?
I mean, yeah, it was a really high pressure sales job. Not all the time, but when they had these numbers, right? Basically, mm-hmm. these numbers that they thought a certain list should hit. So let's say we're calling for the Florida Police Officers Association, for example, mm-hmm. just as an example. And we would call for, police organizations all over the country. But for some reason, they thought, all right, that list needs to hit $250 an hour. Well, if as a group, the entire office was at $250 an hour, well, then they just leave you alone. You're cool. But if you don't hit those numbers, they would like freak out. I mean, there'd be people like, managers throwing shit at the walls. Oh, they'd be screaming. It was really high pressure.
Screaming.
Make
more money. Calls.
Yes. Cursing, screaming, the whole thing. And, for me as someone, I was a teenager I was a kid who just needed a job to, to pay for my life, going out to eat and like things like that.
Candy.
My pizza, my graffiti supplies, that kind of stuff.
Yes, spray paint.
For me, it wasn't like, there was some stress, but for me, I didn't take it super serious. For other people that were in halfway houses, they would threaten people basically with going back to jail. Because you had people that were right out of the halfway house.
Right.
They needed a job to stay, for their part of their parole or whatever, they'd be working at CDG. Well, if you're not going to hit those numbers, you know, we're going to tell your probation officer or your parole officer that you didn't come in today, like something like that.
Yeah.
So you had guys that would come in there, right? And they would actually they'd call their parole officer. Hey, I'm in. And then they would just do whatever they wanted to. They would like pay off a manager, and then they would just like sell drugs out of the office all day. That was one option.
Prison. This is like you're it basically out of
was
prison,
like prison.
It's jail. It's very jail.
Oh yeah,
code.
One caller and a friend of mine, ex Santino the God, who's in episode 1 and 2, mm-hmm. and he was a manager. You know, he got out. He did it 7 years for selling drugs. Mm-hmm. He gets out of prison. He's out of prison for like 6 days. He's in the halfway house. One of his friends from jail tells him, "Hey, I can get you a job at this company called CDG," and you know he gets a job in 6 days. So 6 days after prison, he's in CDG, and he said he was shocked how CDG was. He said it was crazier than being in prison. He's like, I was like, what happened to the world? Like, since I've been out in,
is how every office is.
Yeah,
it's all like jail. I think we're all moving towards it, though. Like, they're looking at prison. Like, they got some good stuff going on over there. We should employ that at Amazon.
There was a lot of pressure, especially on people that were unfortunately caught up in the prison pipeline.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, you make these sales or you're going back to jail. That was basically it.
Which is so wild and predatory, especially because these are the most vulnerable people coming out of prison. They clearly don't want to go back. And your boss is like, either you hit these numbers or you go have to hit the bricks. You got to hit D block. No, that's
yeah.
Like a,
and that's Sabrina, really who was a manager, talked about that a little bit in episode 1. Sabrina, who was a good friend.
And, yeah, she was.
And fun. She was caught up in the prison pipeline as well. She did and she's open about it. Didn't make it in the documentary, but she did a. She was kind of a kingpin in her own right back in the day, and really, really good friend of mine, but a legend. And, you know, she ended up in a drug rehab program, and they said, look, she basically had a choice. You either go to jail or you end up in a drug rehab program and work at CDG. And that was,
wow.
And so she chose this rehab and CDG. So that was her, and then she ended up being a manager there. So that was, her story.
Yeah, she was doing it. This is the black woman, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember her.
Yep.
She was yep. a G. So,
she's
yeah.
Great.
I mean, oh, gosh, this is so awful, but it's also just so fucking fascinating. Jesus. So we get into CDC or CDG getting sued. So after some time, CDG began bending the rules. They were already massaging the rules, and now they're
yes.
bending them. And in 1998, the company was sued by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, for falsely claiming that they were actually cops and donations were going directly to resources such as bulletproof vests. No, they did not. They said, we're going to get them some shields. The next time you see a riot, that gear, you pay for it.
Yeah,
they got
new
batons.
Yeah.
They beat them real good with this new baton.
Yeah.
You ain't seen a cop yeah. beat nobody with no old one, okay? Yeah, so that's wild that they were like, oh, donate for bulletproof vests. They simply changed their business model to a consultation mode where employees would claim that they were calling on behalf of organizations such as the Fraternal Order of Police. And in 2007, the Department of Justice, this is for the, obviously for the audience, Sam, you're like, I know all of this. So the Department of Justice went after CDG again, claiming that the shift in the business model didn't actually mean that they changed anything, which obviously it didn't. Additionally, many CDG former trainers claimed that they were instructed by the company to tell people that they worked directly for FOP and that 100% of the organizations went to the donation, which we all know is lies. So at this point, were you weren't working there anymore? Or were you?
So I was working there. I didn't know that they were in the lawsuit when I was working there. So this was like, so basically what happened was in the 90s, they were mm-hmm. telling people that the callers would tell people, some of them, that they were cops, right? So you'd be mm-hmm. like, hey, how's it going? Officer, Bill yeah. Belansky.
I just got shot. Can you send me some money?
You had callers who were, you had callers who were saying that they were cops,
mm-hmm.
right? Then, and the money was going to go to bulletproof vests.
So goofy.
Then what happened was the FTC had their first lawsuit in the government started their first lawsuit in 1998, and they said, you can't say the money's going to bulletproof bulletproof vest when it actually isn't. You can't say that you're a cop. And if someone asks
normal
you what...
things.
Yeah, normal things. And if the donor asks you what percentage of your of their donation goes to the police or to the organization, by law, you have to tell them. Now, if they if the donor doesn't ask, you don't have to say anything. Only if they ask, you have to say it. So if somebody asked me, Sam, what percentage of my donation goes to the police? Well, I'd say, well, a very generous 10% of your donation goes to the police.
A very and generous usually, 10%.
Yeah, so you'd have to
spin it. As much as Jesus wanted.
Exactly. And but usually people would hang up, you know, because they're like, wait, only 10%, which is really low. Like charity experts recommend that it's 70% goes to the organization and 30% at the minimum is used for expenses.
Right.
We were doing 90-10. So the FTC, so then what happened was, you know, Civic Development Group.
Yeah.
And the biggest police organization in the United States, the Fraternal Order of Police, said, how do we get around? We're losing all this money when people ask us what percentage of their donation goes to the organization. We're losing all this money. And when we would also say, hi, this is Sam, I'm calling on behalf. I couldn't say, hi, this is Officer Littmanstern anymore. I'd say, hi, I'm calling on behalf of the Fraternal Order of Police. Now, they were making tons of money. They just got greedy and they said, how do we change it so that we can say that how can we change it so we can say 100% of the donation goes directly to the organization
without actually
and that we are from the police? Or, you know, but that's how they came up with this crazy consultant model. And what we started doing was we would say, you know, hi, this is Sam Littmanstern from the New Jersey Fraternal Order of Police. Okay, well, and then the donor would say, well, how much of my donation goes to the police? Oh, I got to let you know that I'm very proud to say 100% of your generous donation goes directly to the Fraternal Order of Police.
Now, how were you able to say you were from there? It's like, oh, no, I'm from FOP. I live around there. Like, what's the hell? How would we work that around?
They thought that they had found a legal loophole where essentially the police organizations hired the callers rather than the callers. It was just all legal wording bullshit, right? It's just a small change in the contract. The contract made it so that the Fraternal Order of Police was hiring the callers so that we, the callers, you know, the graffiti writers, bank robbers, all of us wild motherfuckers are working for the police. We're not working for a telemarketing company anymore, but on paper. But it was exactly this. Nothing had changed
other
than
come through and give you the new language.
They actually changed the scripts and everything. And they put a call, they would put a member of the police in the office. So that was pretty crazy.
What? Yeah, that's wild. Hi, I'm Lacey Mosley. I'm calling, I'm a homegirl of the FOP. FOP is my baby daddy. And I need money.
Now, they didn't do that in my office. They did it in my office for the Cancer Fund of America.
Oh, no.
So in addition to these major police unions that we call on behalf of, we'd also call on behalf of firefighters groups and charities, cancer organizations, charities, veterans, and like children's cancer. So like these causes that really pulled on the heartstrings. Now that's another level of the scam was that we would call on behalf of sound-alike charities. So it was, they would, you know, not the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which is amazing. We would call on behalf of like, the Children's Wish Association,
right? The children's got a wish. Wish of the child. Yeah, no, we're with Make Wishes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it was wild. So it was they thought this was a legal loophole, and they did it, and they raised hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's
over
wild.
Over $100 million, and then the government did some kind of investigation. And they took CDG
that's what
down.
We're getting to. Yep. And they were calling for Susan L. Komen instead of Susan G. Komen. Like, no.
Basically, that was the system.
We raced it for cures. multiple cures, okay? It's different, but it's exactly. the same. It's the same. Exactly. We need autocures. So in 2010, the FTC ordered CDG to get out of the fundraising business and pay $19 million in fines, the largest consumer protection fine in FTC history. I always wonder where those fines go, because it's like, is it going to the government? Because it should actually go to who the, you know, CDG was impersonating. But I always feel like these fines, I'm like, where the fines going? Who getting them? Where'd it go?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. That's a good question. I mean, I think.
Can they go back to the people who donated?
Like, it definitely did not go back to any of the people that donated. And you're right. Where did that money go?
I don't know. Yeah, the government just deboed you. They just robbed you. Yeah. Like, that's all. They exactly. ran into your house and took your shit.
Like, we wanted to get that money.
Right.
And then, yeah.
Where does it go? That's like when they put the drugs on the table and it's like, bro, we know you raided the house and y'all put tons of cash in your pocket because it's unaccounted for. But you can put these bricks of cocaine on here. Like, come on now. Y'all thirsty. So, however, no criminal charges were filed, and CDG's shutdown was temporary. Mark Keyser and Stephen Pash were forced to liquidate their assets, including two mansions, original Van Gogh's, original Picasso's, $1 million guitar collection. Damn, it was even more than what you think. $1 million. Three Mercedes, two Bentleys, a Range Rover, an Escalade, and $250,000 in fine wine.
Yeah.
Listen, they got the best
banded.
Grapes.
They made out
Lucille Ball stepped on these grapes, okay? These are the best, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Only the best for our gullet. No! So a month after CDG shut down, Mark Keyser opened a new company, Residential Programs, Inc., RPI. I love that it's always three letters. That sounds so official.
There's so many of them, too. Yeah, it's
and
crazy.
And he continues to make calls on the same, like, behalf of the FOP. They just, like, shut down shop and then opened up shop again. So the ensuing media and news coverage, much of the narrative maintained that CDG was the true culprit, while the FOP and the donors were the victims, which we know not true. So in reality, there were at least several FOPs that were aware of the donation model and schemed to benefit the relationships with the telemarketing firm. So after CDG was shut down, other companies beyond RPI took the model and ran with it, paving the way for cops such as Robert Lozano to start their own telemarketing programs. So wait, Sam, how did it make you feel knowing that even though CDG was shut down, it could pop right back up? Like,
well, yeah, as a new company. I you know, it was wild because, I mean, my friends were like, you know, CDG got shut down. So the owners on paper were Scott Pash and David Keyser. These were two, and all the, and their brothers, they were like two groups of brothers that made the company, right? Mm-hmm. But the CEOs were Scott Pash and David Keyser, two of the brothers. Now, though, one of them had the rock band, you know.
Yes.
Now, those two got banned for life. From telemarketing.
Right. You can't pick up a phone. You got to text for the rest of your life. You can't call nobody.
For the rest of your life. Now, so a couple, so then a month later or so, Mark Keyser's, David Keyser's brother, mm-hmm. Mark Keyser, opens up RPI.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't banned for life.
Oh, because he was like, he
worked
it.
There.
He was making money, but he wasn't the one who was banned.
He wasn't the CEO, you know, on paper.
Oh my gosh.
So they just did the same model, new business, you know, same list, same callers, everything the same. But
they did what they did in the 60s when you commit a crime, you just move 10 miles over and then start a new life.
Yeah, I mean, that was basically what they did. Yeah.
Move one town over and you a new person.
Yeah.
We a new business. We RPI now. I love
exactly.
that. So Robert Lozano and the culpability of FOP. So Robert was the president of the Houston Metro Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 98, until 2019. In addition to being a part of the FOP, he looked like a cop, but he also don't look like he can run fast. Like, what you can't chase nobody on Bad Boys. Like, bro, you gotta.
He could barely outrun us when we rolled up on him.
You pulled up on him. He's like power walking away.
Yeah, power walk. That's slow power walk, but he made it.
There's nothing worse than a slow power walk for a criminal. Like, you gotta be in good shape if you're doing crime. You gotta be able to run. Okay.
That's in full police uniform.
Like, what? How can you stop crime if you can't make it to the crime?
You're right.
Like, hold on. Put your hands in the air. Hold on. I'm coming. Like, no, sir. So In addition to being a part of the FOP, he was also the president of a fundraising company, RG Benefits Inc. They love the letters. You know, that yep. really just solidifies a company here. So that solicited money for the FOP programs to help needy kids. What constitutes needy, and who are these kids?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know.
Kids in need of what? Food? Shelter? Books? Pens? Lisa Frank phone?
Good question.
What are they Who in are, need of? Needy is so good, vague. Yeah. Medicine?
You're right. Yeah.
They said, look, they just Who need knows? Don't worry about it. Just, help them with their needs.
They need something. They need something.
Are you going to give them needs or what? Give them some needs. What? So RG Benefits' contract with the FOP determined that it kept 75% of the donations and the rest went to the general FOP. So, however, none of that money was earmarked for anything donors were told it was going to. The kids still needing. They never gave nothing to them. Not only were the donations going directly to Robert's company, but as the president of the FOP, he had direct access to the general funds. So it's just going to his pocket. He's just pulling it out like his own personal bank.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You know what?
They he took all of it. He took all of it. So he was getting his 75% or whatever. Now, then he was, so he owns the telemarketing company. He's the president of the Houston Metro Fraternal Order of Police. He bled the bank account dry from the Fraternal Order of Police. I think he took over $200,000.
Wow.
Then he's getting his big cut from the telemarketing. Now, one thing that we didn't show is a little exclusive for the podcast, but we interviewed, and it didn't make it in there for time, but we interviewed the current president of the Houston Metro Fraternal Order of Police. And he told us that they were cooking meth in Officer Robert Lozano's office. Cooking and smoking meth. This is in Texas, so it wasn't crack or heroin.
From Texas.
Oh wow. But, okay. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Meth
from
is Houston, a Texas. Highly dangerous thing to be cooking. It can explode. Like, what if the office exploded? Like, y'all doing a Breaking Bad? Like,
it was basically Breaking Bad in Officer Lozano's office, according to the new president.
This Officer Lozano's office always smells so weird, don't it?
They were just cooking and smoking meth in there. I mean, it's like. And he's still a cop. That's the thing that's crazy. Like, he's still a cop.
Yes.
He got fired. He got kicked out of the FOP because I think he took it too far. He didn't give the powers that be their cut. He took, you know, he took $200,000 for himself and, got kicked out of the FOP, but he's still a cop.
Robert said, I'm a kid at heart and I have needs. He took all that money. No, and he's still a cop. That's what's so wild to me because essentially the office that you described of CDG kind of reminds me of the police. It's just like a bunch of fucking criminals who are hanging out and some of, you know, they all got their little scams that they run in. And then just like when one of them got in the fight and beat the manager's ass up real bad, they like, oh, walk it off. Come back tomorrow. Like, what? Why are you not fired? Yeah. But this police officer, they're like, all right, you can't have a bank account no more because you were stealing too much, Rob. And stop cooking meth in there before we get another explosion. What kind of slap on the wrist?
Oh, no, it's crazy. I mean, he still has his telemarketing office.
These people have to
Yeah, he's
job.
Calling right now as we're having
call
this interview.
Calling right now.
But, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, it, you know, again, it's the one, you know, we'll probably go into it in a second, but, like, the fact that the police haven't been held accountable in this, you know, 50-plus year scam. That's the part that is mind blowing to me.
Because the police are like, who gonna check me, boo? Like, I'm the law. So
yeah, and well, the government has nothing. They don't want to go against the cops either.
And it's so funny because when right now we're in a time, at least when we're recording this, that my union's on strike, and the police union is one of the strongest I would say it's the strongest union in the world, absolutely. They get to do murders and then just do desk work the next day. Like, and it's like we're fighting for 2% of, like, you know, billions of dollars from that's created from literally our souls. And so it's like I want to kind of look at the union books for the police because, like, I think every union should be as strong as the police. Like, we got to do something. Like, fuck the police, but I need to see y'all books or something. Like, let me see how y'all did this because this union is strong as hell. No consequences.
I guess, you know, we got to get the writers unions and all the unions calling citizens around the country to raise billions of dollars and then go take that money to the lobbyists.
Let's start a call center. What do we call it? We just need three letters.
Three letters.
Yes. We got it.
Yeah.
I mean, SAG and WGA are already three letters, but we need something like punchier, like RPI. Yeah. Like,
totally.
Q. No.
I like Q.
You like Q? Okay. Q.
I do.
Okay. I feel like it's got to be like a R, like Q, but no, Q, P, T? No. I want it to end in an I. We got to work through this.
C. QCI? I don't
know. QCI! QCI. Oh my God, I would give all my money to QCI. Yes.
We can figure out what it stands for later.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
As long as you have those three letters, you're good.
Minor details, just like the composer. I don't need to know what movie we composing. We just go start composing.
Let's go.
Minor details. Let's go. Exactly. QCI. I love it. So in 2019, bank statements are uncovered when the new FOP president came on, showing thousands of dollars spent on FOP unrelated expenses, including $1,900 on a Caribbean cruise, not the Carnival cruise. Not you eating Guy Fieri burgers on the police dime. And then $224 in charges at beach bars in Cozumel and Belize. $769 in movie tabs in Houston. Damn, you was a cinephile like a motherfucker. $769. And $1,600 on Houston Rockets tickets. Fun. So the account, which should have had tens of thousands of dollars, would bled dry to a negative balance of $18, just like you said, Sam. But not you going in the negative. Like, you really took it too far.
He couldn't leave it at $5. He took it. He went
also
under.
Why are you not pulling out cash? You're swiping the FOP card. You have no shame. So Robert has since claimed that his company never raised funds for an FOP, that he has not been charged with any crime, and his attorney claims that he's been cleared by the Harris County District Attorney's Office. I wonder why. And you even said that there was someone you interviewed who said that Robert's company called and was like, hey, we are the police. Sorry, my siren went off. Hello, it's us police.
Clearly
lying. So though, allegedly, so though not every FOP may have direct ties with telemarketing and firm soliciting donations, they all basically do the same thing. So during the pitches, most of the time, the script claimed that money was being sent to the needy kids. Man, I know the needy kids are pissed. Because they ain't got a red cent from this shit.
No, nothing.
I'm sorry, needy kids. I'm sorry y'all still got knees because the adults are stealing. So, the families of fallen officers. And I know in your documentary, you guys interviewed an officer who was shot in the line of duty, right? Who received nothing.
Yes. Yeah. Which was crazy. I mean, this guy, you know, he was Officer Mike Byrne in Chicago. I mean, he was a member of the Fraternal Order of Police for years. And he actually was up until like 2 years ago. He was trying to stop what seemed like it was going to be a mass shooting someone who was, had a gun in a crowded place. And he was injured in the line of duty. Officer Mike Byrne was called a hero by the mayor's office. The Fraternal Order of Police gave him this wonderful plaque. And then they raised millions of dollars in Chicago, for families of fallen and or injured officers and didn't give a dime to Mike Byrne. And so he sued the telemarketing company and the Fraternal Order of Police on behalf of, like, I think it was 400 officers that were injured.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did they win? Did they get some coins?
They tried to drag out that lawsuit for a long time. Mike Byrne said it was hope. They were hoping that he would die before it ended.
So they ended him out.
Yeah. So the judge who also had received a $10,000 donation from the FOP ruled that the Fraternal Order of Police was not responsible. It was the telemarketing company's fault. They ended up winning against the telemarketing company after 20 years of pushing the case back and back and back. But the telemarketing company was gone by the time they won.
So then who's going to pay them?
That's it.
They had closed
their job. They don't get nothing. Yep.
And moved 10 miles down the road and started a new life. Damn. See, stuff like that, like, I love a scam, but stuff like that really pisses me off because it's like, you could have just gave them a little cut. You're being so greedy. Like, just get, like, you gave the man a plaque. Like, bitch, I can't pay my rent with a plaque. Okay, yeah. AT&T don't want a plaque this month. Like, give me some fucking money, especially because he saved people's lives. Like, that pisses me off.
I was pissed on that. And Pat got a whole new, like, Pat loves Mike Byrne and got a whole new inspiration after meeting him. He was we got to do this for Mike Byrne. Like, finish this thing.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I liked him in the documentary, and I really felt bad that he got scams like that, especially because he put his life on the line to save a lot of other people.
Not to go in too much, but, like, the police... All right, so the Fraternal Order of Police hasn't said anything. They haven't responded to the documentary publicly. You know, I want to start, why don't we have police officers that are out there, you know, standing up? You know, you talked about, like, the thin blue line or whatever. It's like, that's what's keeping this whole thing for the culture in the United States bad.
It's like, you can't be a good Klans member. Like, no, he's the best Klans member. He remember everybody's birthday. And, you know, he always got, like, when you work for a bad organization, it's just like, you become a part of it. And I feel bad for the people who get involved thinking they're going to change it from the inside or who want to help people. Because then when they call out shit that's going on, like, you know, there's a chance you might get murdered. It's happened. Like,
Mike Byrne was getting calls all the time from people when he would start this lawsuit, like, you're going against your own, like, threatening him, all that stuff. So yeah, he experienced it firsthand, and it's like, you know, it really is a gang. Like,
despite CDG having shut down for over a decade, telemarketing is still alive and thriving today, and now benefiting from the use of AI, which is obviously something that we're fighting in our unions. You know, y'all can't scan our background actors' bodies and use them in perpetuity for $100. Like, please be serious and for real. But it also is with AI, because they can do AI to our voices so easily. And it's so funny to me that most of the first things that I saw with AI, as far as, like, celebrity culture, were a fucking black people. They was making Drake and The Weeknd songs. Levi's was like, oh, we're gonna have more representation. We got AI niggas. What is happening? They are really trying to replace us.
Yeah, first. Yeah. And give people work. Like, give people, support people.
Right.
Like,
this representation that you made an AI black person with six fingers. What are you doing?
Yeah, that's actually really, that's messed up. That's really messed up.
So, and I've talked about it before, but it's just like, with AI with voices, your whole speech could be recorded. And then they don't need you. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know how you do AI with sales, because if the person responds, like, it's always like, sales is something you have to be, like, charismatic. Like, Pat had that energy that really, like, you know, roped you in and made you talk to him. You have that energy. You're so chill and easy to talk to. So I'm like, how do you replicate that with AI?
You know, we see it in episode 3, but we got a call from one of our friends who had passed away. His ghost is calling right now from beyond the grave. They recorded his voice.
I'm dead. No.
You know, the one good thing about this industry, in my opinion, is, and we never wanted to demonize the callers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the callers were just, including myself, just people that were maybe down in their luck or in the prison pipeline, or people with a felony because they couldn't get other work.
Yeah, we're not demonizing.
People that just were trying to get jobs. And actually, I didn't even know it was a scam. I just thought it was how cops raised their money until we started the investigation. And other people thought the same thing. You know, these are people that were just trying to make $10 an hour, make ends meet. Now where we're at in 2023 is with this AI and the robocalls, is you're starting to take away the one positive thing about this industry, which is giving people jobs. With the robocalls and AI, you're taking those jobs away. And so what do you have left? What do you have left? You have, you know, just shady police unions, shady charities, and businessmen, and a bunch of, you know, fucking AI and robocalls, which is where it's heading to.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, you're at that point, you don't have anything positive about this crazy industry that we exposed in the documentary. And I have some friends that are still in the industry all these years later on making the calls. And I'll give you a little, like, behind the scenes info that Sam and Pat memes have been banned from the telemarketing chats. You cannot bring up, my friends have sent me screenshots. The managers have banned, because everyone loves us, all the callers. they're posting Sam and Pat me, and we're banned. You cannot mention me or Pat
at the call center.
In the telemarketing call center. Yeah.
I love that. We better not see that shit in the Slack. Don't you?
No, exactly. Memes. We're banned from the Slack. We're banned.
I love that for you. But wrapping this up, so telemarketing today, you pretty much just hit everything. But so the telemarketing firms have moved beyond charities and nonprofits into the world of political action committees.
Yes.
So now they're using politics, which is such a smart move for a scam because politicians, one thing they love is money. It's so funny to me when they come in with that story. It's like, I was rubbing two cans together before I got into Congress. And then they all leave millionaires. It's like, how you get that money? What happened to them two cans?
I've always thought the same thing.
How you get that money, honey? What's going on? We know what your salary is. They posted online. It ain't millions. It's like, no, we'll tell them about COVID after we sell our stocks. And then, like, it's like, what? Oh, my goodness. So they move into the political action committees. PACs is so smart. So it's likely the PACs will face even fewer regulations because politicians on every side stand to benefit from them in the same way that the FOP benefited from the firms. So a handful of politicians have put forward recommendations to address scam PACs and other telemarketing schemes, but no agency has taken any action. These firms continue to function more or less unhindered by new legislation. And I know one of those politicians that put forward the recommendation was Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut. And at the end of episode 3 in the documentary, you talked to him on Capitol Hill. And he seemed kind of dismissive. Like, do you guys think sometimes, like, did you think, like, something like this would come out of the success of your documentary? Like, do you think, like, this pressure is why he's, like, actually doing
something? Oh, yeah. No, it 100% is. So, basically, you know, Rich, we interviewed Richard Blumenthal, which I, you know, he was, we reached out to a lot of senators and a lot of, you know, congressmen and government officials. Pat's dream was to testify in front of Congress. And we were hoping that we could get a congressional hearing on the subject matter. Richard Blumenthal, you know, was, you know, generous enough to give us, you know, an interview with him and to present information about the subject and evidence. Now, we were supposed to get an hour. That's what his staff told us. We got 7 minutes with him.
Wow.
What you see in episode 3 is basically, it's almost unedited. You know, he gave us 7 minutes. Pat, I think, shined in that. You know, you get this. He really came prepared.
He
had his evidence. Yeah, he rocked it. And then Blumenthal said that his staff would meet with us right after the interview. And he left. After 7 minutes, and his staff came back in and said, "Hey, you guys ready to pack up?" And they didn't give us any time to speak to the, to speak to them about the situation. So we followed up with like 80 pages of evidence, and we heard radio silence, so we didn't hear anything. So then the documentary dropped
on that ass,
and he did an interview with a Connecticut newspaper, saying that, you know, there was a misunderstanding. Mm. He was a little bit off put by Pat's untraditional interview style, specifically taking his sunglasses off in a dramatic like fashion before the interview. hilarious that he said that. But, you know, the one thing that I was a little bit disappointed in personally was that the senator didn't mention or didn't speak to the police union's involvement in the scam. And in my opinion, that's what keeps this industry going, is the major police union's involvement. And until they are held accountable for what they've been doing, I don't think, you know, I think this, you know, could keep going on for a long time. Like, so, you know, I want to see the Fraternal Order of Police held accountable by politicians and, you know, and because they're the only legitimate, quote unquote, legitimate.
Right.
Police organizations, not just legitimate, the biggest police organizations in the world, and they're wrapped up hand in hand in this scam. And then you have all these other scam veterans, firefighters, children's cancer, and now they're doing autism packs now.
Oh my goodness. Which is such a like a QAnon dog whistle. I just want to ask you, Sam, like, do you have any final thoughts or anything that you didn't say about this or your experience? Anything you would want to share?
Well, for anybody out there, like, you can look up these calls online. I mean, they're happening as we're doing this call, as we're doing this podcast. You can find calls online. People, if you search No Mo Robo, it's a website that actually
No Mo Robo. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm a total nerd on this subject, so like, I love this shit. But if you search like police No Mo Robo on Google, you can. There's an app that catches these calls.
Oh.
So you can see the different organizations that are calling right now online and listen to the calls. And it's pretty interesting. Another thing is just check out some of these organizations that we used to call for. The Cancer Fund of America was one of our biggest clients, and they were on, there was an American Greed just about the Cancer Fund of America. This was a family, they had a bunch of, a family who had a bunch of cancer charities, and it was a total scam. It was a, you know, they're a big scam. There's
that down, Judas. We're gonna have to look into the Cancer Fund of America.
Yeah, it's a good, that's a good little rabbit hole. Bobby Thompson, and I think it was called the Navy Veterans Association. This was a guy that was a total con man who was doing like 30 different identities. Has pictures. He got all the way up to having pictures with George Bush and working.
Oh my goodness.
And it was a total scam. He's in prison right now and said he was like a CIA operative. Like that's a whole other rabbit hole to go down.
I might have talked about him. Yeah. I think I might have talked about him. Yeah.
Yeah. So he would use, you know, he would use telemarketing companies like CDG and some of the callers that we interviewed were calling on behalf of his organization. But yeah, if you get a phone call, you know, for one of these charities, you know, you can mess around with them, find, get some information. Hey, what percentage goes or something like that. But just, you know, really, you should just hang up. Don't give over the phone. And Americans are very generous. There's a lot of great charities out there. And, you know, if they, I think do your research, do your due diligence.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of our goals was to try to tell this story so that the money starts going to the right
places.
Place. Yeah. Because we're talking about billions of dollars when you really look back. I mean, we found out this scam goes back to like the invention of the telephone.
Damn.
So we're talking about a long time and a lot of money that just was like poof, gone. And you know, if we could, if this could be regulated or stopped, and we could, you know, the money could start going to the right place. So, and also never demonize the telemarketers. We're, you know, just in my opinion,
never. We don't punch down. We only punch up.
Yeah,
and just. I think you're amazing. I think you're such a genius. Like, seriously, like the way your brain works, you're very brilliant, and it's been so lovely to talk to you. And I agree. Like, we can get the money to the right place, because there are a lot of great. I know I'm a cynic on the show a lot, but there are a lot of great charities that are actually helping people. And it is so devastating to know that this money was going to, like, you know, Houston Rockets games and you know, Cozumel margaritas and shit. Like, when it should be going to the actual people who need it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that that's a really great point, and that we all have to do our research. Man, like, it's so hard to, like, actually have media literacy. And a lot of times people aren't taught media literacy. So they will, like, get their news from media takeout or from, like, a random post on Twitter. You can post a photo of someone and put a headline caption on it, and people will believe it's real.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other wild
subject. So, yeah, look into the charity.
I totally agree. And, no, you're a genius as well, and I appreciate that kind words. And I'm always, if you ever need anything at all in this realm, this wild realm that I've, you know, been researching, you know, always happy to help.
I really appreciate it.
Honor being on the show, a blessing.
Sam, we always ask at the end of the show, like, where would you like to be found? Anything you want people to see? Any social media handles? All of that.
Yeah. So I'm at Sam_Lipman Stern on Instagram. On Twitter, I just made one after the show. I hadn't
Welcome
had one
to hell.
For a long time. I'm at Sam Lipman Stern as well. And my website, samlipmanstern.com. And you can watch Telemarketers on Mac and any, I think it's on Hulu and Amazon Prime, basically anywhere you can get the HBO add-on. And I just want to thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
This
and,
was a thrill.
I'm a fan
I'm
of the
so
show.
Excited.
Well, thank you.
It went so well. I was so nervous, Sam. I'm so excited. As usual, guys, if you want to see the crazy videos and everything, Scam Goddess Pod on all platforms. And then if you want to follow me, D-I-V-A-L-A-C-I, Diva Lacey on all platforms. Congregation, y'all. Oh, my God. Stay Sammy. Yes, Sam. Yes.
Scam Goddess.
This has been an Earwolf production in association with Team Coco. Scam Goddess stars and is hosted by me, Lacey Mosley, a.k.a. Scam Goddess. Our producer is Judith Cargbo. Our production coordinator is Abby Aguilar. And our audio engineer is Sam Keeper. Research for the show is done by Caitlin Brandt. Stay scamming.
Hi, I'm Cyndi Lauper. My scalp was covered with psoriasis, which could lead to psoriatic arthritis. But Cosentyx treats both.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for TB. Serious allergic reactions, severe skin reactions that look like eczema, and an increased risk of infections, some fatal, have occurred. Cosentyx may lower ability to fight infections, so tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if IBD symptoms develop or worsen. Learn more at Cosentyx.com or 1-844-COSENTYX.
Cosentyx works for me.
Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at tmobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at tmobile.com.